Hello, and welcome to episode 47 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a freelance writer, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Okay, we'll get to my interview with Ian Martyr in just a few minutes, but first the news. Not too much this week. I've been super busy working to make sure the Day of Empathy event in Michigan is amazing, hopefully, knock wood. For those who are not aware, the Day of Empathy is a national day of action to generate empathy for people who have been impacted by our criminal justice system on a massive scale. I have been involved in all three Day of Empathy events in Michigan. As I might have mentioned last week, in my first year I was a helper, last year I was a speaker, and this year I'm organizing the Michigan event. But this isn't just an event to me. Nothing matters more than reframing decades and decades of dehumanization heaped on the families of people who've been incarcerated and the people like me who've been arrested, imprisoned, and are now trying to live a normal life. Despite being labeled and ostracized, treated as less than human, and sometimes as less than human. And this is not just a Michigan event. If you are looking for the event in your own state, go to dayofempathy.org/events, scroll down, and look for your state. You should be able to sign up right there, and then, you know, find the event in your state, go there, and stand and be counted with us as we try to fight for a more humane criminal justice system. Okay, a few days ago, I was part of a town hall event and community listening session in Ypsilanti, Michigan, based on the idea that people should have an easier time clearing their criminal records. We had an amazing turnout and incredible participation. It was amazing to be there. What most people don't understand is that research has clearly shown that it is not the crime you commit that best determines recidivism. It's the amount of time crime-free. We need to make it easier for people who have a felony background to clear their criminal records and get back to living a normal life as fully vested citizens of the United States of America as soon as they possibly can. Okay, and now to my interview with Ian Martyr. Many months ago, I noticed I had people listening to the podcast in Ireland. I was always curious as to how that happened. A few weeks ago, Dr. Ian Martyr reached out to me from Maynooth University. Now he'll be my first international guest on Decarceration Nation. Dr. Ian D. Martyr joined the Department of Law at Maynooth University as a lecturer in criminology in May of 2018. He holds a BA in criminology and criminal justice, an MA in international and comparative criminal justice, and a PhD in law, all from the University of Leeds. He was formerly a research associate at the Department of Sociology, Social Policy, and Criminology at the University of Liverpool, where he worked on the public engagement strand of the N8 Policing Research Partnership. In 2017-2018, he acted as scientific expert to the Council of Europe's Council for Penological Cooperation. Since May of 2016, he has also been a visiting fellow at the Durham and Darlington Restorative Hub. Ian is the founder and manager of the Community of Restorative Researchers, a research network open to all persons and organizations involved or interested in restorative justice or restorative practice in any capacity. He also works closely with the European Forum for Restorative Justice and other professional associations helping to develop restorative justice policies and practices and improve the accessibility of research in this field. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Ian.
Thank you very much, Josh. It's really, really nice to be here.
So can you talk about how you got from Canada to England to Ireland, and then how you started to get into the work on restorative justice, wherever that happened?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I actually moved to the UK when I was quite young from Canada, even though perhaps I don't necessarily sound like it. But my parents are academics, so I moved to the UK when I was pretty young. And I studied criminology at undergraduate and master's level, as you just said. And at undergraduate, I studied a module on victimology and restorative justice, and it was something that really, really spoke to me. I think when I grew up, I was very interested in international politics. I read a lot of things like Noam Chomsky and people like that, and I read a lot about international conflict and came to be very strongly of the view that it was just a totally pointless endeavor, and also feeling like there should be some way to reduce or resolve things like that. So, I mean, that's not directly related to criminology, but when I studied restorative justice in criminology, it very much felt like, you know, here is a tool and a framework that could potentially be used to reduce the harm caused by conflict. So after my undergraduate, I worked as a researcher for Restorative Solutions, which is an NGO in the UK, and they're mostly a restorative justice training and service provider. But at the time, they were evaluating a particular project which looked at the use of restorative conferencing. And that's, to be clear, a process where victims and offenders would come into communication with each other. They were doing a project on that post-sentence. So it was all burglars who had been to prison and victims of their burglaries. So I conducted some research with a colleague interviewing those victims to see the impact it had on them, to the impact of meeting the offender. Then subsequently, I worked for the Restorative Justice Council, another UK-based organization, also as a researcher, where I conducted some research on the use of restorative justice with young adults. There I was in particular studying practitioners' attitudes to that particular endeavor. And about a year after that, I started a PhD that focused on the use of restorative justice by the police, looking at its implementation in two police forces in England. And this lectureship is my first kind of full-time job out of the PhD. And here I will be teaching restorative justice to undergraduate and master's students. I'm conducting various pieces of research and engagement on the topic of restorative justice. And as you said previously, I also did a little bit of work on public attitudes and also with the Council of Europe, for whom I drafted a new Council of Europe recommendation on restorative justice.
Wow, you've done a lot of work. I'm involved in a group called Friends of Restorative Justice Washtenaw County here in Michigan. So it was a little bit of a surprise to me when you correctly mentioned that I haven't really done an episode on restorative justice. So I'm really glad we're getting to have this conversation. So for folks listening who aren't insiders, what is restorative justice? And I know in one of your articles, you have a bunch of possible sets of definitions. Can you break this down so that it might make sense to people who are coming into contact with this for the first time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, restorative justice for me is best defined as a process of bringing people who have been harmed by crime and conflict and people who are responsible for that harm and bringing them into communication. And the purpose of the exercise is to what in the field is called addressing and repairing the harm. So in that situation, everyone would get the opportunity to express why something happened or the impact it had on them. And then equally, there would be some sort of outcome agreement, some sort of collective decision making that sought to find a positive way forward. So that might be called restorative conferencing. That's one model. Another model is often referred to as victim-offender mediation. You can also have circle processes. And those are just different ways of structuring dialogues involving victims and offenders, but also perhaps members of the community or supporters of either party, like their family members, for example. And this can happen at any point in the criminal justice process, anything from kid steals a chocolate bar from a store, and instead of arresting the kid, the police officer, say, offers restorative justice to the offender and the victim, the storekeeper in that situation, all the way through to the other side where someone commits a very serious crime, such as a murder. They go to prison for a very long time. And they would meet in the case of a murder or come into communication with the family of the victim, possibly early on in the prison sentence, at the midpoint, all the way through to much later, even after a person has been released. So defining it as a process, that shows that this is something that can really happen in almost any context, including non-crime cases. So you could use this with bullying in schools, neighborhood conflict, workplace mediation could have a restorative angle to it. Some of the important factors there would be that it should be totally voluntary for all parties and that there is general agreement about the facts of the case. So this is not a forum for determining guilt. If someone pleads not guilty, and they do not accept responsibility for something that has happened, then you shouldn't use restorative justice in that situation. Equally, there might be agreement over the facts of the case, but one or both parties does not want to come into communication with the other party, and that has to be respected too.
So what, if anything, has made you certain that a system based around restorative principles might be better at delivering at least healing and maybe justice than a more traditional Western kind of punishment-based system?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think there's room for both. I mean, I think that restorative processes, like I've just described, those should be available to everyone. You know, there might have to be some practitioner discretion to assess risk and to deny a formal restorative process to people in very extreme cases where they would be too risky to do that. Same as in mediation, there would be cases where the power imbalance is so great or a party is so manipulative that mediation or restorative justice would not be appropriate. But I also think that the accessibility of restorative justice should not be based exclusively on factors like the severity of the crime or the geographical location of the victim, as it often is, or also the age of the offender. And the reason I think that is because there's some fairly strong empirical research which indicates the potential benefits of this. That includes research on, for example, reducing reoffending and positive benefits for offenders. So while there has long been research into this process, it is research more recently, which I usually draw on because it has the most methodologically rigorous approach. So for a long time, studies showed very, very high reductions in reoffending through restorative justice. But those were usually studies in which they had not controlled for the variable of because it's voluntary, because someone doesn't have to do it. If a person agrees to do it from the offender's side, then perhaps that might be someone who is already on the path to desistance. So what some studies have done is to control for that variable by only giving restorative justice to half the people who agree to it. So, for example, there was one famous, quite large-scale study by Joanna Chaplin and her colleagues from the University of Sheffield. That was in the UK. And that found a 14% reduction in reoffending. Now, 14% maybe doesn't sound like a huge amount, but actually that is quite significant. If you look at various probation interventions, you would be hard-pressed to find specific interventions with that high an effect rate. And what's also significant about that study is that that was all with relatively serious and persistent offenders. So burglars, persistent burglars, serious violence, those were all cases that went to the higher English court. And the overwhelming majority of offending, which is low level, that goes to the lower court. So there's relatively strong evidence on reoffending, but there's also really some quite strong evidence on benefits for victims as well. So that same study found that victim satisfaction was at 85% satisfaction with the process. And that is quite high, especially when you compare it to research on victim satisfaction with court processes. At court, you know, victims are very rarely given a chance to participate in any significant way, or even where they are asked to participate, it's always the rules of the court and the desires of the prosecutors, which dictates what they're supposed to say and when they're supposed to say it. Really, what victims want to be able to do is express themselves directly or as directly as possible to the people involved. Not all victims, of course. But a lot of the victim satisfaction with restorative justice, I think, comes from this ability to just express yourself exactly the impact it's had on you directly to the person. So unlike at court, where the offender is held accountable to the state in abstract, in restorative justice, they're held directly accountable to the victim. Victims also, I think, get a lot of satisfaction from the ability to participate in the decision-making, especially at the lower level. There are a number of countries which use restorative justice as a diversion from court. And in those situations, often the victim and offender would agree on a series of outcomes that might include various forms of reparation, other interventions for the offender, and also symbolic things like apologies and assurances of future behavior. And I think victims get a lot of satisfaction from that. I think also a lot of victims go into restorative justice with pro-social motivations. There is some really good research on that by, I think, Tineke Van Kamp, and also Inga Van Frechem. They studied that victims quite often, especially adult victims and young offenders, will actually want to participate and get satisfaction from participating because they do want to help. They want to see the situation not happen again. And they come to be of the view, often correctly, in my view, that by engaging in this kind of process, they can build empathy with the offender. They can convince the offender that, you know, you do have an impact on people, and so you should try to resist or move away from these kind of behaviors going forward. And one more thing about the research very quickly, which is that there's also evidence about benefits in terms of victim recovery. So not just that victims get more satisfaction maybe than with court or other traditional processes, but also that, that if they have post-traumatic stress symptoms, these might be reduced through restorative justice. So one study by the Cambridge Center for Experimental Criminology found that things like anger at the offender, fear, and other post-traumatic stress symptoms, they all fell in victims who had participated in restorative justice compared to victims who were similar, a control group of victims, but who had not participated.
So you said earlier that these might not be mutually exclusive systems, but at least in the United States, we have a system that discourages responsibility and accountability because admitting guilt or taking responsibility often can increase punishment, the loss of family, and the loss of community connections, and potentially a lifetime of discrimination. How would a system built on restorative practices not create kind of a moral hazard for the person who was participating, at least in our system?
No, that's interesting. I mean, that's a question that people often have. As I say, restorative justice could take place at any stage of the criminal justice process. So, for example, if it is offered to you as a diversion from court, you could say that, you know, there is a perverse incentive for the offender to participate because the alternative could be worse. You could just as easily say that about someone who is in prison and they're offered restorative justice, and then, you know, they might do it because it looks good at a parole hearing. So absolutely, I mean, there can be certainly incentives on offenders to participate. But I don't think that's inherently a problem, because you could just as easily say that with any diversionary program. You know, if an offender is offered, if for example, an offender is offered some sort of community order, but if they breach that order, they'll go to prison. Well, then there's, you know, the motivations might not be pure to engage with those services. Equally with an education program in prison, well, are you really wanting to engage with this, or are you just doing it to get out earlier? So that does exist. Now, in restorative justice, there is a particular issue, which is that if an offender goes into this with, I'm using the notion of impure motivations, you put the victim at risk. And that's not something which happens with these other interventions I've just been comparing it to. But I mean, what I would say there is a couple of things, one of which is that it is the job of the trained and skilled facilitator, the person who acts as a mediator, to determine whether the person's motivations are so impure that they will actually put the victim at risk. Now, it may be that someone goes into this thinking, oh, well, it's just another thing I have to do. But then when they're confronted with the victim, that actually does make them think, you know, give them a second thought in a way that other interventions might not. Because being confronted with a victim who directly explains, for example, with burglary, you know, it wasn't just that you took my stuff. It's that, you know, now I'm terrified to be in my home. My kids were there and they're really worried. I feel invaded. All of these things that, first of all, the victim is best positioned to describe. But secondly, even if a practitioner were to describe that, that would have I think, less impact on an offender than hearing it directly from the victim. So there's that difference there. But also, I would say, you know, in countries like Belgium, for example, where there is quite strong emphasis on restorative justice relative to other countries. And there often practitioners say, you know, it is okay to have a default of restorative justice, because you can just, you know, if the offender comes to it and they say in the preparation, because 95% of the work is done in the preparation. So if an offender is saying, well, you know, I don't really care about the victim, but I've agreed to do this anyway. The practitioner can go to the victim and tell them that. They can say, you know, this is what the person said. Do you wish to continue? And the victim is free to pull out, or they are also free to go in and say their piece. And maybe the offender is not going to take it so seriously, but there is still a benefit for them. So while I think there is potential moral hazard in that sense, I don't think it's an insurmountable problem.
Well, what about the alternative problem, which is, for instance, say I may have pled guilty to a certain amount of things, but the way that I've explained it, for instance, to my friends and family, is that I only did this but not this. And then the process of restorative justice might ask me to disclose things that might put my relationships at risk.
Yes. Yeah. No. And it's interesting you say that, because that is one of the most difficult practical issues, in fact, especially where restorative justice is being used as a conditional diversion from court. And what is supposed to happen, or the most kind of principled approach, would be that discussions which take place at restorative justice are confidential unless, for example, you know, someone describes an imminent serious crime. You know, it'd be the same as in any situation where if someone discloses to a practitioner that something really bad is about to happen, then with the best will in the world, that practitioner has to report that. They would have a duty to do so. But I mean, if you, for example, have pleaded guilty to a couple of burglaries or to a couple of shopliftings, say, and you are offered, okay, we'll divert you from court using restorative justice, and if the process is successful, you won't get a conviction, but you'll have to undertake whatever obligations are agreed upon in the process. And if in that process you say, well, you know, I've actually done a couple other shopliftings, then really that should be confidential. That should not be used against you.
Okay, so one of the things that surprised me from reading the articles you sent me is that justice systems around the world are incorporating restorative justice. There are small steps to do so in the United States, but could you give us a more accurate picture of how this is being done in other systems?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, certainly in the English-speaking world, the jurisdiction which has implemented this the most would be New Zealand. Since, I think, the early 90s in New Zealand, there has been legislation which requires judges to postpone sentencing after a plea of guilt for young people in order to offer restorative justice at that point, which is not to say restorative justice has to take place, because either the offender or the victim could opt not to do it. But that is the way in New Zealand that they've integrated it firmly into the criminal justice process at the pre-sentence stage. And in fact, in 2014, New Zealand introduced new legislation, which meant that this was also the case for adults. So now, and I think there's maybe a couple of exemptions, like something for which there would be a mandatory life sentence, but for basically all cases which go to court and at which someone pleads guilty, the judge in New Zealand now is required to postpone sentencing, to adjourn, to allow restorative justice to take place in between a plea of guilt or conviction and sentencing. And equally in New Zealand, there are programs to offer restorative justice in prisons, to offer restorative justice as a diversion from court altogether. But the reason I focus on that pre-sentence piece is because that's statutory. That's a legal obligation on judges to do that. There are other countries which perhaps don't have legal obligations to offer restorative justice systematically, but where there is a legal obligation to provide a restorative justice service. So, for example, in Norway and Finland, there are national mediation services, really, but which offer mediation not just in civil cases, but also in criminal cases. So if you know, that they can take referrals from across the justice system. That could be a diversion from court, that could be in prison, or could be a probation referral. What's interesting at the moment is that there are a number of countries, well, countries are at different points with this. There are some countries which don't have any legislation and don't use this at all. There are some countries like, for example, Portugal and Malta with really quite decent legislation, which simply hasn't been implemented. So there's no service to provide restorative justice. There are other countries like, for example, the Czech Republic, where the probation service has a statutory responsibility for providing restorative justice, but where referrals and the use of victim offender mediation has declined quite a lot in recent years. And there's countries which are kind of going in the other direction, like, for example, in England and Wales, where I did my PhD. And I say England and Wales because in the UK, Northern Ireland and Scotland are separate jurisdictions for the purpose of criminal justice, and England and Wales is one jurisdiction. So in England and Wales now, there are a significant number of local publicly funded restorative justice services, most of which didn't exist even, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, but which now have the capacity to take referrals at pretty much any point in the criminal justice process, although there's no statutory obligation on anyone to actually offer it at any point. So you can see this kind of works differently in different countries. Another place that has a statutory obligation to offer it would be Belgium, where since 2006, for young people, prosecutors who make the diversion decisions, they're obliged in almost all cases to opt to consider or explore or some language like that, restorative justice as a diversion from court with young offenders. So it's reasonably well embedded in the youth justice system in Belgium, although less so at the adult justice system.
So I think it would be fair to say that we've had some issues over the last decade in particular, and probably for many decades prior to that, that weren't spoken about as much. Between community and police relations, especially in regards to people in communities of color in the United States. One of your papers is about how police incorporate restorative principles in other countries. Can you tell us more about what police departments are doing and a vision for how potentially this could transform policing?
So there was a really, really good book by Kerry Clamp and Craig Patterson called Restorative Policing. That was published in 2017. And there they outline really quite a broad normative vision for using restorative justice to transform policing. And they would say that restorative policing, if I get this right, is defined as a new policing objective, which is to build beneficial forms of social capital. So they would say that in order to transform policing, you have to emphasize the relational element of restorative justice. You have to say that to build restorative policing, the police have to understand that kind of informal social control through the building of relationships, the building of social capital, should be their primary objective. So, I mean, you've got that. That would be what's called it, like a systemic approach to restorative policing. You would also have what's called programmatic approaches. And that might be where the police simply deliver restorative justice as part of their day-to-day work. So I know there's a couple places in the U.S. where in the 90s and early 2000s, I'm not sure if they still do it now, but I mean, there's definitely a couple places where police officers have simply been trained to facilitate these kind of face-to-face or indirect encounters. And that could be with anything from neighborhood conflict, other non-crime incidents like antisocial behavior, all the way through to cases which the police are criminal, but which the police might have decided they will resolve out of court. So, you know, low level or minor youth or adult offending. And the police could simply deliver restorative justice in those kind of cases. Restorative justice could also be used in response to public complaints against the police. There's been a couple of experiments with that, including a quite successful one in England, but that was never rolled out. And what you often find in restorative justice is that there is lots of really successful small-scale experiments, but there's seldom the political will to invest heavily in making this systematically available. Now, equally, in terms of police-community relations, this is a really interesting point because there have been a couple of experiments which have used restorative practices as a way to address that harm and try to rebuild police community relations. I'm thinking in particular of an experiment, again in the UK, that happened in two southern counties, Gloucestershire and Northamptonshire, where restorative practices were used to get police together with young people who were at risk of coming into contact with the police. And the idea is that through dialogue, you could build trust, build relationships between these people. And the evaluation of that, which was conducted by a friend of mine, Brian Payne, who's a lecturer at a Northern Irish university now, he found that in advance of that, police officers saw very little that they could do differently in order to have better relationships with young people. And equally, young people saw the police as very uniform, I guess. Very, you know, they're just people in uniforms, and they didn't appreciate the kind of individual nature of police officers. They just see the badge. And then after those meetings, it was found that police officers had lots of different ideas that they could do to treat young people differently because they understood young people better. And similarly, young people were more able to think about police officers as individuals, you know, saying things like, you know, oh, I never really thought about the fact that they all have feelings too, you know. So, I mean, I think that restorative practices could be really, really useful for helping to build relationships between really any groups that mistrust each other. That could be police officers and young people. That could be equally two ethnic groups, for example, where there is some underlying tension or conflict. And I mean, of course, the point also is, and you made this point in your question, that there are communities who rightly feel that they have been subject to particular systematic harms at the hands of the police. And I do think restorative justice has a role to play in that as well. I think that, it depends on the individuals in question. If you have individuals who have personally felt wronged by other officers, then you could have restorative conferencing between those persons, and as you would in a situation where there's a public complaint against a police officer. But at a more sort of community level, I think it would be a great idea, and as I say, there have been a couple of examples of this, I think it'd be a great idea to facilitate dialogue between communities who feel under attack or mistrusting of the police and the police officers in those areas. And I think that through that process, the police could better understand why people feel like that, perhaps reflect on how their own behavior contributes to that, but also just building more positive relationships where the community might feel more able to have to have discourse, to discuss these issues directly with police officers.
So I also wonder if there's a vision for how restorative practices might help transform prisons, jails, probation, and parole.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, in prisons, start with prisons. You have, again, the kind of two things I've been describing have been the use of restorative justice reactively and the use of restorative practices proactively. So reactively, I mean, you know, there's no reason why everyone in prison cannot be offered the opportunity to communicate with their victim. And likewise, the victim would be offered the opportunity to communicate with them. That would be a reactive approach. That's kind of what's normally understood by restorative justice or restorative conferencing. And equally in prisons, that could be the way that you respond to a conflict between prisoners or between prisoners and prison officers. And there was a really good report by Kimmett Edgar of the Prison Reform Trust from the UK again, where he reviewed some of the literature in this area and suggested that a more kind of conflict informed approach needed to be used in both prison adjudication, but also in responding to prison violence. But then also you have this kind of proactive side, and that's what I was talking about when I said, you know, get the police and young people together, not because necessarily of a specific incident, but because there's an issue to discuss, and that's this underlying mistrust, this underlying inability for the two groups to understand each other and humanize each other. And you could do that in prisons too. In prisons, there is this notion of dynamic security. That is security which is achieved through consent, through the existence of positive relationships between people in there. And I think that these kind of practices, restorative practices, and in particular sequential circle processes, could be used in order to build more positive relationships in prison, to build more of a sense of communities in prison. And also, I think that training in these approaches, that in itself is a capacity building exercise, because if you can build the skills of prisoners around reducing tensions, reducing conflict, and also responding effectively and nonviolently to conflict, then that's likely also to transform prison environments. Or I should say, it has the potential to do so. You mentioned also probation, and I think in probation, the way that restorative justice would be used to transform it, again, you know, you could have restorative justice simply as an intervention which is used with commuted or suspended sentences. So the probate, so someone is sentenced to 2-year probation order. That means that maybe they have to meet the probation officer once a month, and in between that, they have to undertake, you know, unpaid work, drug interventions, anger management, and they might have other conditions placed upon them. And restorative justice could always be offered as an intervention there. But if you really want to transform probation, and likewise with these other agencies, what you need to do is to have restorative justice as the default option. So that's when I say, you know, there has to be some sort of balance between traditional and restorative ways of doing things. Because if restorative doesn't work, i.e. if the victim doesn't want to do it, or if for some other reason it's just not appropriate or not successful, then you have to be able to revert back to existing processes. But I think that you can transform things to a very significant degree by having restorative justice as the default. So let me give you an example of that in the context of probation. In advance of all those interventions I just described, there's a part of probation work called sentence planning work. And that's where the probation officer, either by themselves or sometimes in collaboration with the offender, they basically decide what kind of interventions are going to happen, or you know, how they're going to happen, or in which order, or whatever it is. There's some discretion of probation workers to kind of design the interventions and whatever's going to happen during the community sentence. And what you could do there, I mean, that's a decision-making process. And because it's a decision-making process with multiple stakeholders, that means you can do it restoratively. So there'd be very little to stop a probation service from having as its default approach, okay, so you've been sentenced to a community sentence, so why don't I try and hold a restorative conference first? And the victim will be involved, the offender, potentially other stakeholders, like I mentioned, that could be the families of both parties, that could be significant persons in one or both of their lives, members of the community, members of indirectly affected communities, whatever it may be, all the people who hold a stake in the resolution of that crime. Get those people together. And you would both have the portion of the process which addresses the harm, i.e. get the people to talk about the impact it had on them, what they were thinking at the time, what they've thought about since, and then also some decision making. So what needs to happen to put things right? That's usually how that kind of question is phrased, or often it is. And you could have, you know, you put together an outcome agreement. And the probation worker can contribute to that too, and then can sign off on that as a sentence plan. So just in that, you've transformed probation from something where the state tells the offender what to do to something where the state delegates authority, delegates responsibility for decision-making to the people who are most closely involved, a much more participatory approach to decision-making. That's really what restorative is about, in my view. It's both trying to find more positive, harm-focused outcomes, but also mainly about the participatory approaches to decision-making.
So you talked a little earlier about lack of political will, and then you've also said in a few of your papers that restorative practices sometimes get captured by institutional imperatives. Could you talk a little bit about implementation and overcoming the lack of political will?
Definitely. So the capture by institutional imperatives, that is a risk which requires careful management. So, for example, I'll use the context of policing because that's the area I know most about. So policing has some very system-focused goals, including things like efficiency, including the need to balance the rights and needs of the stakeholders in front of them against the needs as perceived by the police of their own institution and of the wider community. And some of these goals and imperatives are in contrast or contradict those of restorative justice. So, for example, the police officer is used to, first of all, deciding things on behalf of people and doing that as quickly as possible. Whereas restorative justice is all about the police officer devolving that responsibility to those with a stake in the outcome of the incident, and also taking the time to enable dialogue at a speed and in a manner which is most responsive to the needs of those participants. So what you have often, and there's a very good paper by Kathleen Daly from 2003 called Mind the Gap Between Theory and Practice in Restorative Justice. And what she talks about, among other things, is that there's a gap between theory and practice, i.e. the theory of what restorative justice is supposed to be and supposed to achieve versus what happens when the criminal justice agencies get their hands on this in reality. And she focuses in particular on organizational routines. And she says that if you have an agency which has always done something in a particular way, i.e., for example, the police deciding things on behalf of people, then what you'll end up getting in practice quite often is some sort of hybrid process when you try to implement restorative justice. So you might have, for example, in many cases, the police might ask people what they want and kind of facilitate this dialogue in the way that I've been describing. But in some cases, they might try to coerce people into participating. That's quite a big risk in restorative policing. Also, you might have police officers potentially imposing outcomes on people. That's a risk in restorative policing. Those are both things that the research on restorative policing has shown can happen when police are responsible for facilitating these kind of face-to-face encounters. Now, again, I think that's manageable. I think that overall, when the thing is well-designed and there's been sufficient emphasis on training and oversight, the benefits, in my view, definitely outweigh the risks. And the risks can be lessened through careful management. But then even then, that requires the institution to spend to expend sufficient resources on training in the first place and give its officers enough time to actually facilitate and prepare thoroughly. One of the other risks is because criminal justice agencies often are all about efficiency and closing off cases as quickly as possible, they might put insufficient emphasis on the lengthy preparations which can be required in order to deliver restorative justice safely, especially where the crime is particularly serious or one or more participants are particularly vulnerable. So there's all sorts of risks like that, and those are well documented in the research. And I think the challenge for research going forward is to find the best ways to manage and reduce those risks and essentially maximize the benefits and minimize the risks going forward. In terms of political will, you know, that's something else altogether, because, you know, restorative justice is a good example of a social policy innovation, which is reasonably well evidenced, which probably would have positive outcomes for the people who participate. But, you know, there's no obligation on any government to actually invest in this. And that's where political will is really important, because it is a bit different to what they would do otherwise. It takes a lot of political will, not just to invest sufficiently in doing something different, but especially for something as potentially complex as restorative justice. You know, they have to justify what they're doing. And, you know, that you can't just, you know, get every member of the public and explain, well, it could have this benefit in this situation, this benefit in this situation. You know, restorative justice is not, in my view, it's not massively conducive to really easy sound bites. And so a couple things happen, one of which is politicians think, you know, well, that's too complicated. Like, why would we expend energy on that when there's going to be very little political capital built from it? What others have done, and this is how it's been very successful in the UK, is that they portray it largely or even exclusively as something that is for victims, because, of course, that is very difficult to argue against. So in the UK now, or in England and Wales, I should say, restorative justice is framed as a service for victims. And it's always described by political leaders as something which is good for victims, because then they get a chance to go and express themselves. And while that's absolutely true, you know, it's only one part of the picture. So there's risks with framing it like that as well. And I did a podcast a couple of years ago with Lisa Ray from Restorative Justice International, where we kind of get into this debate a little bit, because on one hand, it is very important for victims to drive restorative justice and to be seen as at the forefront of restorative justice, because, you know, that's the most politically expedient way of doing it, but also because, you know, the whole a huge part of the point is to use it to help victims. But then on the other hand, it's very important to somehow achieve a very balanced approach whereby restorative justice is not just, you know, something that we do to offenders because it helps victims, but something which I like to see it more as a kind of a neutral platform through which you can identify and hopefully meet the needs and interests of all the parties involved.
So you talk about needing to talk in sound bites and that sometimes restorative principles don't work that well in that context, but that is kind of the situations that we usually face in the United States. So what possibilities and potential do you see for introducing restorative principles more here in the States?
Yeah. So, I mean, usually what happens in countries that have done this, or in parts of countries that have done this, is that someone just takes the initiative. And that is that, you know, in the criminology literature, we might call that person a moral entrepreneur, i.e. someone who, because of their values, takes the lead on something when actually there might not be a huge amount of personal benefit to them doing so. So if you look, for example, at Colorado is the state which, if I understand correctly, and it's difficult because a lot of restorative justice stuff happens kind of under the radar and you don't really hear about it, but Colorado is certainly a state where there is a huge amount of emphasis on, or I should say, a significant amount of emphasis on restorative justice, including a number of new pieces of legislation in recent years, including legislation which requires restorative justice to be funded, which set up a new body to coordinate it, which provides obligations on practitioners to consider using restorative justice with young offenders. And that pretty much, if I'm not mistaken, that's largely the work of a particular state representative who has brought all these bills forward. I can't remember the guy's name now. I think his last name is Lee. I think he's Representative Lee. And you can find a lot of his work online. There was an article I read online which actually just listed all of the criminal justice reform bills that he brought to the floor of the Colorado State legislature. And of course, behind him, there would be tons of activists, all sorts of people, including people within the criminal justice agencies, and also people in civil society and academia too, who have been, you know, pushing this, experimenting, lobbying, and doing all sorts of things in order to promote restorative justice. But in Colorado is a good example of a place where, you know, you need someone who is a decision maker or someone who has a lot of influence to find restorative justice, think it's a really good idea, and put their neck on the line to promote it. Now, what happens in other places, and this happened, for example, with the first major experiment on restorative policing in England, happened because the chief of a police force went to another country where they were using restorative justice, and he saw it happen and he thought, oh man, that looks like a really good idea. And then he brought it back and implemented it in his police force. So that's something that you hear about quite regularly when you hear about a new restorative justice initiative, often at the level of a criminal justice agency. That's because a bunch of one or more senior people did a study visit somewhere, actually saw it happening and thought, okay, we need to do this. And that's the other interesting thing about restorative justice, is that describing it is very complicated, and getting into the nuances of all the potential benefits and the risks and all that stuff, that can be quite complicated verbally. But people find it very, very easy, or certainly easier to understand when they see it happening. And that's the benefit of study visits. That's the benefit of videos. So often when I'm teaching restorative justice, I use videos, including videos which show a conference happening, videos in which a victim describes the impact of participation on them, and also videos in which an offender describes the impact of participation on them. And YouTube is full of really, really interesting videos which illustrate this.
So if someone came up to you and, you know, was particularly, tied to the notion of punitive justice, and they said, you know, why in the world would we want to provide this service given that, what would you say?
Well, I mean, I'd say a couple of things. I mean, first of all, people who are into punitive justice would still surely want to, we want services which help victims to exist. So, I mean, that is the advantage of restorative justice, and why it does have some political capital attached, is because there is strong evidence that victims who participate benefit a lot. But if I were to try and make, you know, an argument that, you know, that offenders should participate in this, and why, you know, because ultimately what you're asking is, you know, why should anyone have any sympathy with someone who's done something wrong? So, I mean, I would say...
I get that question a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's a few things I would say that I often say in the general terms. And I say things like, you know, I don't think that someone should be judged exclusively based on the worst thing they've ever done. I also say things like, you know, put your hands up if you've actually never committed a crime. You know, I very rarely get a huge number of hands, show of hands when I do that in my classes. And then in specific terms to restorative justice, I would say, you know, first of all, you have to think about the complexities of life and the complexities all of the complications, all of the reasons why people do the things they do. And you can't just say someone's done something bad and that makes them a bad person. What you should do is look at all the circumstances, think about how structures, everything in society combines with people's agency, all the choices they make, those two things combined. That's the best and most sophisticated way to understand human behavior. So it's no good just saying, well, you chose to do that, so you get everything that's coming to you. I don't think that's sufficiently nuanced, and I don't think that that makes good criminal justice policy. But equally, as I say before, the thing with restorative justice, you know, this is not exclusively like, I'm not saying, okay, everyone who's ever committed a crime, let's divert you from traditional criminal justice through restorative justice. I think that that should be an option as often as possible. And that would be an argument that would be very difficult to make to someone who's very, very wedded to punitive things, to the punitive way of doing things. But, you know, do those punitive people really think that someone who's been sentenced to prison shouldn't be given the opportunity to talk to the victim if the victim would also like to talk to them? You know, that has no impact on sentencing. Although, again, I do think that diversion should be used really as much as possible. And actually, I think that there's some pretty strong research to support that, because often what people who want punitive approaches, they do think not only, you know, this is normatively correct because someone who causes harm also deserves to suffer, but they're also of the view that punitive approaches should happen because that's an effective way of reducing crime or deterring criminal behavior. And that is not supported by the research. The research indicates, first of all, that deterrence or punitive sanctions as a deterrent are not particularly effective because people don't assume they're not going to get caught. So it doesn't matter if you bump up the sentences. If you assume you're not going to get caught, it doesn't matter. And either that or people don't care about getting caught. And that's how you can have a situation where people still commit capital offenses in a country with the death penalty. Like if the death penalty is not going to deter you, then bumping up, you know, a sentencing from 1 year to 2 years in prison for a medium level offense, you know, it's intuitive that that's not going to have any effect. But then also at the much lower level, there's research which shows that bringing children in particular into the criminal justice system and low level offenders into the criminal justice system, that can actually be criminogenic, i.e., make it more likely that they're going to go on to commit more offenses. And there is recently, for example, a systematic review of research on police diversion conducted by Dr. Wilson and colleagues. That's available on the Campbell Collaboration website. And that found that police-led diversion results in less reoffending than prosecuting someone. So, you know, you can argue that you simply think that someone deserves to suffer if they've caused some harm, but you can't really make the argument that in doing so, you are, you are destined to have a positive impact on them going forward, because that's not consistent with the research evidence as I interpret it.
I always ask the same last question in every interview. What question should I have asked but didn't? What did I mess up?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess also just to mention the Council of Europe recommendation. So there have been a number of important international developments, one of which is that the United Nations is currently reviewing its own materials on restorative justice. There's going to be an updated restorative justice handbook. There was a new resolution on restorative justice passed at the UN in May or June, I think it was. No, in May it was, May last year. So they're doing all sorts of work in this area. And also at the Organization of American States, the OAS, they passed a resolution last year which promoted restorative justice in that region. There was a European Union directive on the rights of victims of crime in 2012 that included restorative justice. And then more recently, there was this Council of Europe recommendation, which I worked on. The Council of Europe is different to the European Union. So the European Union is 28 countries which are very closely integrated. That's the thing that the UK is leaving in a couple of weeks. The Council of Europe, in contrast, is a much looser group of many more countries. That includes all of Eastern and Southern Europe to, or most of it anyway, compared to the EU. And that runs things like, for example, the European Convention of Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights. It's mainly just a human rights organization. And they produce all sorts of guidance on, for example, minimum standards for prisons, minimum standards for probation and supervision. And then just last year, as I say, they adopted a new guidance or regulation on restorative justice. So what I'm really hoping to do is use that recommendation, which isn't legally binding on member states, but which does carry a lot of political force and has a lot of legitimacy. So I'm hoping to use that to kickstart or certainly help to continue pushing a number of developments across Europe, including countries which barely ever use restorative justice at all, and so need to start somewhere, and also countries which maybe have reasonably well-developed restorative justice systems, but maybe where their focus is only on reactive approaches and the kind of proactive stuff I was describing earlier, that's where they could use restorative principles and restorative approaches in order to not just have it as an intervention, but actually achieve more of a cultural change in the system or in their institutions.
Okay, well, I think we covered an awful lot of ground here. So I really want to say thanks for reaching out to me and for doing this. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Josh. I really, really appreciate it. Great to talk to you too.
All right, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
See you later.
And now, my take. I've been getting mildly frustrated over the last few weeks because I keep hearing people who say they are down with our cause, but those same people keep talking about people who shouldn't get relief, the ones that are beyond redemption. In every discussion, it seems like someone has a group of people that they exclude from reform no matter what. It's a different group for every single person I talk to, but it seems like there's always a group. For some, it's political. Jesse Smollett falsely accused two people, and while troubling and deserving of attention and probably some form of condemnation, the people that he accused are now vindicated after a few weeks. But people on the right want to lock up Mr. Smollett and throw away the key. As criminal justice reformers, we generally believe mandatory minimums are bad and long sentences are counterproductive. But when the object is someone we don't like Paul Manafort, all of a sudden, many of us on the left are okay with long sentences and want Mr. Manafort to face a lengthy mandatory minimum. And then we have what happened in Florida. Everyone celebrating, and to some extent even myself, the expansion of voting rights that restored over a million formerly incarcerated folks the franchise. Except that when they did it, they left some of the most discriminated against folks, the people who most need a voice, out of that reform. People who committed murder and people who committed sex offenses. The people who most needed representation were left behind. And not only did they leave them behind, but they did it through a constitutional amendment, which makes it almost impossible to see how in the world we would ever go back and undo that damage. We also have folks on television like Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow who talk a good game about criminal justice reform until someone they don't like comes up, and then they and the rest of their MSNBC colleagues are right back to calling people convicted felons or even worse. And even among advocates for registry reform, too often folks are so worried about making sure that they get off the registry, a feeling I personally understand very well, that they often have no problem throwing those other people, the ones that are too dangerous to allow for redemption or relief ever, under a very large bus. Finally, you have the folks that say that they believe in criminal justice reform. But until meaningful reform happens, we should have equally high punishments for everyone. If a poor person had to survive brutal prison, everyone should have to survive in brutal prisons. I don't do this work to provide equally harsh punishment for all. I do this work to be part of creating a system to create equally less punishment for all. I don't do this work to create equal injustice for all. I do this work to create equal justice for all. And I don't confuse punishment with justice. This is a movement about treating every single person with dignity and humanity, not about deciding who gets to be treated with dignity and humanity. I am never for a brutal and punitive system. In my mind, the test of treating every prisoner with dignity and reimagining our criminal justice system starts with how you treat the people that you don't like, the tough cases, not just how you treat the most sympathetic folks. I am so tired of hearing about, oh, the problem with our criminal justice system is that it doesn't have relief for nonviolent drug offenders. If you got rid of every drug offender, and I'm not even talking just nonviolent drug offenders, in the state system, we would still have a massive mass incarceration problem. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have relief for nonviolent drug offenders or offenders at all, a word I don't particularly like, but that's the term that they always use. Of course we should have reform for them, but the idea that that's the water's edge at which reform should stop is crazy to me. I understand that a big part of Michelle Alexander's book is this idea of drug offenders. I hate using that word. I'm sorry I keep repeating it. But that is literally the term that everybody uses. Unfortunately, while it is a groundbreaking and incredibly important book, Michelle Alexander's book is talking about the federal system, not the state system, where most people in prison are housed. At the federal level, drug offenses are about 60% of the population, I believe. In the state system, it's much less than that. In fact, over 50% of people at the state level, over 50% are in prison for violent crimes, which means if you were to just do relief for nonviolent folks, much less drug offenses, you would not touch mass incarceration. Okay. I don't want to confuse anyone. I don't like Paul Manafort very much. Okay, he helped elect brutal and ruthless dictators that have caused massive suffering in the lives of people all over the world. But that doesn't mean that I wish a long sentence on him. The point isn't really him. It's what the system is supposed to be about. I don't believe that punishment is justice. I hope he finds contrition. I hope he makes amends. I hope he truly takes responsibility for what he's done. Part of the reason I support restorative justice is because it replaces punishment with accountability and cruelty with healing. We have told each other for too many decades that justice is the same as vengeance, that somehow being cruel to people who we don't like is okay, and that it'll heal us, and that two wrongs magically make a right. That has not been my experience. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. And make sure to check out our new t-shirts, sweatshirts, and hats, which I still don't totally have my head wrapped around, but it is real. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, and to Robert Alvarez, who's been helping with the website and put together our merchandise. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.